So this study was commissioned by the IMC, which is a not-profit organization. They wanted to understand better aspects of sexual violence in order to create programs for sexual violence survivors. Funding was from USAID. So a little bit about the DRC, Central African country. Our study was located in North and South Kivu, which is on the eastern part of the country. Population is about 75 million. Median age is young. It's about 17.7 or 18 years, with a life expectancy of about 56 years. Female literacy is low at 57%, and a high prevalence of the population lives below the poverty line. So the history of the Congo, it's been marked by political instability and violence. Even in the past 20 years, from 1994, which was the Rwandan genocide, immediate following was the First Congo War and the Second Congo War. It's estimated that about 5 million people died in that Second Congo War. The result of that was a lot of instability and infrastructure devastation. In 2003 and 2008, peace accords were agreed upon. However, conflicts and racial tensions still continued. In 2003, there was also the election of a transitional government, which also affected a lot of the instability and infrastructure of the country. Currently, or around 2012, it's estimated that about 2.7 million internally displaced persons exist in the Congo. So this instability brought the presence of armed soldiers and rebel groups from many different factions. They've been accused of numerous human rights violations, including using sexual violence as a weapon of war. It would be something to intimidate or humiliate the population. So sexual violence, as we defined it, was the WHO definition, which is any sexual act, attempt to obtain a sexual act, or other act directed against a person's sexuality using coercion by any person, regardless of their relationship to the victim, in any setting. In this particular study, we focus on violence against women, even though violence against men is also prevalent in Congo. So a little bit about sexual violence in the DRC. They vary widely. It's estimated that about 20 to 40% of women, on the broad estimates, had reported being exposed to sexual violence in their lifetimes, whereas localized reports are up to 70%. Of women reporting being sexually assaulted or brutalized. A lot of this is coming from soldiers. So a lot of the perpetrators are actually soldiers, both government and rebel factions. However, increasingly it's thought that more and more civilians are also taking part as this kind of culture gets a little bit normalized in communities. So survivors of sexual violence face multiple issues and challenges, including medical, psychological, and social. And it's also in the context of a lot of stigma and discrimination, including negative community attitudes, which makes seeking care, counseling, and justice very difficult. So in order to address this, the increasing prevalence of sexual violence, the law of 2006 tried to amend and clarify what is meant by sexual violence and clarify what would happen to perpetrators, which is, you know, up to 25 years in prison. So that brings us to the study. The study was qualitative, it was formative, and it was looking at five regions in North and South Kivu. There were 20 focus group discussions. They were made up of 6 to 10 participants each, and 4 focus groups per location. These focus groups were also made up of adults, adolescents, men, and women. There were 13 key informant interviews. These included community leaders, NGO members, counselors of sexual violence survivors. It was conducted in Swahili, and those who conducted the focus group discussions were from the communities in the Congo and working with IMC. It was transcribed and translated into English. We were in close contact with the Congo team at each stage of the analysis and the collection of data. The analysis was an inductive approach using Atlas TI as the software mechanism for qualitative analysis. So our overall objectives was really to understand better the perceptions of community members in each of these locations about current legal processes for perpetrators of sexual violence. Also to explore factors that contribute to out-of-court settlements when sexual violence occurs. So there are kind of these broad general themes that emerged these are about 200 people that were kind of talking about sexual violence. So the discourse of sexual violence is nested in these broader contextual issues in political instability, of poverty, and existing social norms. The participants, many and most, express a lot of frustration and anger at the court system and the legal processes for handling cases of sexual violence. And out-of-court settlements were mentioned as extremely common in every location and in every focus group, and were perceived by some to even enable sexual violence to occur due to lack of accountability of perpetrators and the ease in which they kind of got off on incidents of sexual violence. Many times, they would be discussing cases that A, were disclosed, and B, were from more civilians, where community had kind of this cohesive sense of accountability for the perpetrator. Much more difficult were soldiers or people who were kind of transient through communities. They were less likely to be going through this process. So a little bit about out-of-court settlements and the way that participants described the process. By far, it was discussed as the most common way to deal with incidents of sexual violence. And what would happen would be a payment of an agreed amount would be exchanged from the perpetrator to the survivor's family. A lot of times, this would be mediated by community leaders or religious leaders. A couple of participants mentioned even the court system saying, why don't you just kind of handle this? Many times, the negotiation would not even actually include the person who had, been exposed to the case of sexual violence, and it would be between her family and the perpetrator. And then once an agreement was reached, the case would be dropped, and it would not be discussed. So this is a quote from an adolescent male. Sometimes the chief may call the two parties and ask them to reconcile and say it is not a matter to be sent to the police. Sometimes the parents of the girl may refuse that the case go to the police and ask that there should be an amicable understanding. So as this was kind of emerging from the data, we were really interested in what was enabling these out-of-court arrangements. Why was this happening? And why was this kind of better than going through a formal legal system? So two broad domains emerged from this. One was issues with the formal legal system, and the second had to do with potential social ramifications for survivors or families if a case was in fact disclosed. So issues with the formal legal system varied. However, the most commonly discussed was bribery of a court official. Would be payment to a court official of a certain amount. Many people expressed frustration over this because when they thought justice was occurring, there was an arrest or something, they would see the perpetrator on the streets a few days later. So that was most common. Relation to a member of the court system, if you had a friend or a relative that was part of the court system, a lot of times they also would not be held accountable. Inefficiencies of the court system. Again, the infrastructure is not great. They're trying to rebuild. They're in transition in terms of governments. So a lot of this is also having to do with lack of communication, lack of efficiency, and also for people who lived in communities that were not very close to a courthouse or something, they would be responsible for transportation as well as transportation fees, court fees. Sometimes the hearings would be delayed or there would be no follow-through. And it just was much more discussed as much more of a hassle. And again, the infrastructure and policing. So two quotes. One female adolescent states, because here in Congo they don't know how to maintain law. They can punish a rapist, then after some days take him out of jail. He pays only money because the owners of the Congo these days are those who have money. And the male adolescent, in terms of amicable arrangement, this practice persists since people do not trust in the police. So, you know, it happened at two levels, where either they don't trust the police to actually arrest the perpetrator, and then secondly, if the arrest occurs, they're brought to court and they feel that there's not going to be accountability if you have money. So another extremely common and very powerful force were social and gender normative influences. The potential social ramifications for disclosed incidents of sexual violence. The repercussions weren't just individual, but they were for the families or even the communities. Married and unmarried women suffer different consequences. A lot of the participants discussed kind of what a woman, you know, to describe, you know, what a woman means to them. And it, a lot of times the life of the household, someone pure, someone giving. And if a woman was raped or violated in any way, it was thought as that she was tarnished, her reputation and potentially husband's reputation and family's reputation was at risk in terms within the community. Unmarried women, the biggest fear by far spoken about of the participants was that if she did, if it was disclosed that she was raped or attacked, then she would not be able to get married. There she would have no suitors, and that was a huge issue for many women that were discussing it, and that was again across location and gender. So lastly, the sexual violence was embedded in a larger culture of silence surrounding sex and sexuality. It wasn't openly discussed. It was thought of as taboo to discuss a lot of aspects of sex and sexuality. A lot of times they mentioned if you're going specifically to talk to someone such as a counselor, an NGO, and kind of not within the community, that's when you talk about these incidents, but not within each other's families or anything. So this is a quote from an adolescent male. They do not speak about this case openly, fearing their daughter will miss being married. Besides, they think that bringing the case to court will generate conflicts between families, and according to our customs, this spoils the young girl's reputation and is a taboo. So again, there is a lot of, this is perpetrators most likely that are within the communities, civilians. And again, most of the incidents reported are from soldiers. So again, this is all nested in this broader kind of issue of poverty and political instability. The role of money, a lot of them kind of were stated that kind of money trumped justice when it had to do with sexual violence. If particularly in families that really were struggling financially, it not only they would get paid for this, but their family reputation would be preserved. They didn't have to go through the hassle of the court system. There were so many rationalities of why to, you know, settle this out of court versus going through everything else that is much more challenging. Years of political instability and war were discussed as causing significant changes in their villages. A lot of them stated that they didn't really have a huge problem with sexual violence, or at least to this degree, until the, you know, soldiers, armed soldiers came into their communities. Also, I should mention, a few participants mentioned that also getting food and water in remote areas in the more rural communities was women going alone were a target as well. So they discussed kind of that balance of needing to feed their families and how they could maybe get access to food and water in groups or something to protect themselves from these incidents. Soldiers, again, identified as perpetrators. And the common overarching view that there is a government failure to protect and provide for citizens in the case of sexual violence. We're actually working on the quantitative part to this, which is also very interesting, but we don't have the results at this point. So this is another two quotes, one from an adult female. old men with money keep raping little girls and pay a fine to either the family of the girl or at the court, and they are released. Nothing will be done at the police or due to poverty. They accept that the rapists give them an amount of money as a fine. An adult female. Here in Bunkerini, we do not know anything about rape, but since the war burst, FDLR came and taught the population about rape. FDLR is a Rwandan rebel army faction. So, in conclusion, there are obvious issues with the current legal system's ability to handle cases of sexual violence. A lot of this has to do with just the country trying to recover from a lot of devastation and infrastructure damage. There's a lack of faith in the legal system, and social norms and lack of accountability seem to foster these alternative ways of dealing with sexual violence. Out-of-court arrangements are extremely common and may enable existing stigma, silence surrounding sexual violence, and even incidents of sexual violence if they become normalized and they don't feel that there's any kind of accountability held to those who are perpetrating the violence. This should be obviously investigated further to understand more specifically the reasons for out-of-court settlements and the legal system's ability to justly prosecute offenders. And not only should the legal system and the process and the infrastructure be targeted, but also in the context of these social norms and the discrimination, stigma, and silence surrounding sexual violence. So, again, limitations. So there was, in each region, variations in translation and transcription. They were all standardized and trained interviewers and the whole team was really wonderful there, but it was really difficult to get kind of really good standard transcription. The focus group discussions, prone to power dynamics and group normative opinions, especially the adolescent groups, which were 13 to 17, there are a lot of peer kind of normatives and pressures. There was varied understandings of what constitutes sexual violence. Even though a standard definition was given, a lot of them were talking about rape in particular, and I think there are many, many different forms. A lot of them didn't feel that, you know, a husband forcing a wife to have sex is sexual violence, and so that kind of entered in the discussion. And lastly, participants have had varying exposure to sexual violence. We didn't ask them specifically, have you or a loved one been targeted? At least I'm not dreaming and I have to wake up. So participants had varying exposure to sexual violence. We didn't ask intimate details of, you know, have you been exposed or a loved one has been exposed. These are all just talking about community perceptions and their own perceptions about sexual violence and what's happening in their own communities. So just a thank you to everyone who contributed to the study. Thanks.